Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from New York City. We have an empowering hour today. We're going to talk about most elderly breast cancer patients receive unnecessary radiation, Duke University. We're also going to talk about how eating breakfast reduces cravings and overeating, University of Missouri. How animal therapy reduces anxiety and loneliness, especially in college students, Georgia State University. Study shows how medication is frequently unintentionally given incorrectly to young children, Nationwide Children's Hospital, and a lot more on health and healing. And then we're going to look at what I'm beginning today is laying out some ideas for those individuals who are social activists or thinking about running for political offices around the country who want to have some really solid themes that we can all benefit from. So I'm going to have progressive programs to restore America. Also today, Academic Madness and the Politics of Exile by Professor Henry Giroux. And 50% of American workers make less than $28,000 a year. Contaminated GMOs cannot be contained. A new scientific paper. As you see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. We know that most elderly people in the United States, when they're diagnosed with cancer, they receive standard radiation therapy and then chemotherapy. Here is my question. What proof do the oncologist and the therapist have that it's actually going to do good instead of reducing the quality of life and actually being a cancer-causing agent? Because a lot of people who have cancer end up getting a therapy that causes cancer. Last night on 60 Minutes, there was a segment involving what they said was the wealthiest man in Los Angeles, worth $11 billion. And he was a medical doctor who came up with this new concept of how to, at the DNA level, genetic level, how to map the weaknesses in the DNA. And therefore, that then is tested on every patient. And then they're told what kind of chemotherapy to receive. And, of course, he would be making money on every single test taken, which means that virtually every cancer patient would be given this test, which means he would make tens of billions of dollars. The problem is there's no proof that it actually works. And what I was thinking when I was watching this is how many years, decades, I have spent traveling all over the world to find people who have long-term survivors of cancer therapy who had terminal cancer. They were given up. They use non-toxic and natural therapies, and the patients are alive today. Now, we're not talking about unscientific therapies. All of these people, everyone, was a board-certified physician. Most were academics. They had all published in the peer-reviewed literature, and their files were open. There were no secrets. It was just they believed, all of them, even though they had never met one another until I brought them all together for a conference in New York City. They'd never even spoken with one another. But they all believed that the body has innate healing ability. So if you give the body two things, and this is true for all illness, if you take away that which causes the underlying pathology, such as inflammation. So if you look at what causes inflammation, stress causes it, alcohol in any amount causes it, fried foods, Animal proteins cause it. So if you take away the pro-inflammatory part, or if you take away the chemical part, which is also pro-inflammatory, like pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, if you take away the heavy metal part, which is also pro-inflammatory, like mercury, lead, cadmium, aluminum. So if you take away that which causes the cells to become defective, then you rebuild the body's immune system. And the most successful of all the therapists I could find in all my research, and this was independently verified by Dr. Audier of Leiden University, it is Dr. Joseph Issel's therapy. And if you look at Issel's therapy, what he did, he took all these patients who were at his clinic, and I was at his clinic several times, and every single patient had been through all the traditional therapy. They'd been to MD Anderson and all the top cancer hospitals. They had done all that they could be done, and then they were sent home to die. And then they found out about Issel's, and they went to Issel's. And Issel's was able to do the basics. He got rid of all inflammation in the body. He then built up the body's immune system. They were drinking fresh green juices. They were eating bowls of berries. He would make them big shakes. I was in the kitchen. I went through every single stage. I wanted to see every single thing he did. He would have them listening to meditation music and inspirational music, guided visualization. He was in magnet therapy. He would take out all their local infected teeth. The things that no one else has ever done, he did. And as a result, he had the highest cure rate for terminal patients in the history of the world. Here is the latest from Duke University. A randomized clinical trial supported the omission of radiation treatment in elderly female patients with early-stage breast cancer. Despite this evidence, a new study reports that almost two-thirds of this group of patients still receive radiation treatment today. The randomized clinical trial, often regarded as the gold standard in evidence-based medicine, demonstrated that the administration of radiation to patients who had received surgery and the drug tamoxifen did not, I repeat, did not improve 5-year recurrence rates or survival rates in elderly women diagnosed with early-stage tumors. Radiation therapy has been considered the standard treatment for early-stage breast cancer for many years. However, it appears that practitioners are reluctant to change their ways. In the study published in the peer-reviewed journal Cancer, the authors state that the omission of radiation therapy has not been widely adopted into clinical practice. So let's get this right. Here is the gold standard that shows that people receiving women radiation therapy do not live a longer life, nor does it improve their cancer. And yet it's still done. Why? That's what I was saying. You're dealing with reactive personalities that are so conditioned to believe in the paradigm and their role in it and their authority stance in it. They refuse to look at the truth. Almost all of science is unscientific. Almost all of medicine is completely unscientific. And yet, they claim to be the superior policymakers and opinion leaders in a field that they know nothing about. Outside of emergency medicine, it's just one giant mess. But just another study to prove it. Will they change because of this study? If you had a million studies, no doctor in America would change. They can't. They've been wedded into the idea that, well, you've all been there at some point or know someone who has. When was the last time a doctor gave back the money for a therapy that failed or a patient that died? When that starts happening, then you know there's some movement towards changing the paradigm. I've mentioned many times being overweight is going to undermine your health. And yet we continue to be overweight. More and more people, including children, are overweight. This is from McGill University, published in The Lancet, Diabetes and Endocrinology. Quote, life expectancy can be reduced by up to 8 years if you're overweight. 8 years. Now, that's just being overweight. That does not include how much life expectancy you lose when you have high blood pressure, when you have heart disease, when you have diabetes, when you're depressed. So now, take those others in consideration. You understand why people are living into their 50s and dying instead of living to be about 130, which you should. So knock 8 years off of your life expectancy for being overweight or obese. Good news, and this is published in from University of Cambridge, quote, eat your greens, they're good for you. Three separate studies conducted by researchers at Cambridge University and the University of Southampton, both in the United Kingdom, found that the more vegetables you consume rich in nitrate may reduce the production of a hormone by the liver and kidneys, and which is a erythropoietin. This hormone regulates the number of red blood cells in the body. The team explained that at high altitudes or in cardiovascular disease, the body is subject to a shortage of oxygen. In order to get more oxygen, the body increases the particular hormone and in the production of blood cells. But when you're not living at a high altitude and you're starved for oxygen, as most people are because they sit all day and they're not exercising and they're eating food that is highly acidic, then you need this, and vegetables give it to you. So, if you want to reduce obesity and diabetes and heart disease, that's what it says here, eat your vegetables. And that's good. Also, more people, according to the University of Georgia, are depressed because they lack vitamin D, especially when it's not sunny out and they don't go outside. This was published in Medical Hypothesis, and it's called seasonal affective disorder. It's a form of depression. It usually begins in the fall and continues through the winter months. It affects a lot of Americans, about 30 million Americans, where they feel sad or anxious or fatigued, where they can't concentrate or irritable, and or a sense of hopelessness. So what do we do about it? Take your vitamin D every day. You don't have to take a lot. 1,000, 2,000 units is fine. That will help. Now, from the University of Granada, this was an interesting study that showed that the antioxidant activity in citrus juices is undervalued. Quote, a new technique developed by researchers at the University of Granada for measuring this property, meaning antioxidants, and their value, are 10 times higher than those indicated by current analysis methods. The results suggest that tables on the antioxidant capacities of food products that dietitians and health authorities use must be revised. Orange juice and citruses, juices, or other fruits are considered healthy due to their high content of antioxidants, which helps reduce harmful free radicals in our body. But a new investigation shows that their benefits are greater than previously thought. Quote, the problem is that the antioxidant activity of the solid fraction, the fiber, isn't measured, as it's assumed that it isn't beneficial. However, this insoluble fraction arrives at the large intestines, and the intestinal microbiota can also ferment it and extract even more antioxidant substances, which we can assess with our new methodology. So what they're saying is that as you consume something that has, like blueberries, that has high fiber and is rich in antioxidants, they didn't measure all that fiber, and that's the bulk of the product. So they're saying that 1,000% more antioxidant is made available in the lower gut and absorbed into the body. Well, that's terrific. So that means that the more red fruit, juices, concentrates, or powders you take, you could be getting 1,000% more benefit. That's just good. So I'm glad that they had made a mistake and are revising it. And finally, a natural substance found in red wine has an anti-inflammatory effect in cardiovascular disease. And this is from University Mainz in Germany. And it was done at the Department of Pharmacology and the Medical Center. And it says, resveratrol inhibits the formation of inflammatory factors that trigger cardiovascular disease. Okay. There's probably 6,000 studies already in the literature on the significance of resveratrol. If you eat grapes, you're going to get more than if you drink wine. If you drink grape juice, you're getting more than if you drink red wine. If you have a concentrate of, let's say, grape juice, where they wick out about anywhere from 30 to 50% of the water out of a grape juice, and they have a grape concentrate, you're getting way more than if you drank wine. If you have any concentrated powder of grape, you're getting a huge amount over what you got in red wine. You would have to drink a case of red wine to get what you can get in concentrated powder. The good news is, this is just one more study that shows when you're having your resveratrol, you're lessening your inflammatory effect on cardiovascular disease, and that can save your life. And that's important. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to take a break. Be back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting from our studios in New York City. And we know a lot of you are listening over the different portable listening devices and cell phones, and we thank you for listening in. We're approaching 15 million minutes of people listening over the telephone alone. That number is 712-432-7231, 712-432-7231. And because you never know when you're traveling and you need to listen in. Before we go to commentaries, and the Iraq War veteran who simply tells the truth, and we got to listen to what he has to say in order to help prevent the wars and help to honor all the vets who today are injured, homeless, and the victims of our wars. We'll go to that also. And then a society of captives and the war on consciousness. So we have a lot to share today. No guest today. Let me also mention that it was great seeing so many people at the premiere of Poverty Inc. I've been down to about 7 showings, and people from all walks of life have been attending. We thank Professor Michael Hudson for being there. And Richard Wolff is going to be there, I believe, this evening. Great economist, a person who tells the truth, that has for a long time. And as we're doing this as a fundraising for our sister station, New York City, WBAI, we hope that you take advantage. Now, I can only be there 2 more nights for the 7:15 show. But I'm even inviting the people who are coming to the 9:30 show to come in when I start to talk, so they'll get the conversation before they actually see the movie, the other people at the end of the movie. That's tonight and Thursday, our closing night. So if you have not made your reservation yet to see Poverty Inc., this is what some have said is the most comprehensive, complete program on inequality, on greed, on those in power, on how they got there, It's a real tapestry of insight. It's almost 2 hours long. Call this number, 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. Also, I heard from Roy of Hollywood. A whole lot of people came out to the Lamley Theater in Pasadena when he was there. And Dr. Ellen Brown, Professor Ellen Brown, was there. She's also in the film. And out there, we're showing it 5 times a day at the Lamley Theater, Pasadena, until Thursday. Now, this coming Sunday, as I do all of my films, I go out to Long Island to the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington to make a presentation of the film and do a question, answer, and discussion afterwards. That's Sunday, December 14th at noon. If you'd like to join me in Huntington for Poverty, Inc., the premiere out there, the one and only time they'll be showing it, one time, call 631-423-7610, 631-423-7610. Anyhow, my hope is it will get people motivated. Now, one of the things that I believe we should do is we should start to re-empower ourselves. Don't assume when you walk down the streets and you look at the skyscrapers and you look at the big projects and you think, who builds these things? Who has the money? Who has the power? Who has the connections? Who has the wherewithal? And you think of syndicates or people with enormous amounts of capital or the capacity to have enormous amounts of loans. That's not you and I. What you and I can do is we can start to pull ourselves off the existing grid and impact them, impact those in power. When we stop shopping at their Walmarts and stop watching their television, stop buying their clothes, instead buy clothes made in the USA, union labor. When we buy our foods, make sure our food is locally grown or organic or at least fair trade if it's not grown locally. When we start realizing how much power we have to make positive choices individually and collectively, then we can start a new movement. And the existing movement can't change. It's too corrupt. It is just has too much support from too many vested interests. They're not going to modify anything. They may say they will, but they won't. So I'm going to share over the next year on a weekly basis some insights, I believe, that can make a difference in where we can start to restore America. First and foremost, let's start with health care. Compared to the other top 10 developed nations, the United States is dead last in health care. We have the highest cost, the worst quality care. We're the most inefficient at delivering that care. We have the most excessive administrative cost. And equitable care for all income classes should be the standard. Our overall healthy lives of a population should be what's focused. We should have a department of healthy choices where in every community in the United States, people want to be healthier, people want to lose weight, people who have diabetic children, people who have hyperactive children can go to a center and have holistic, non-invasive application of the latest science, where we can help people lose weight, reduce their incidence of heart disease, stroke, diabetes, obesity. That would alone save us over $1 trillion a year. $1 trillion. The only way we can do that is with a national single-payer healthcare system that will reduce the cost by over half. Our current costs are $3.3 trillion. So we're going to save over $1 trillion by preventing disease and over $1.5 trillion by getting rid of the bureaucracy and the profit incentive within the healthcare system. Savings would enable a national healthcare initiative that could put more emphasis upon disease prevention and higher health education and would further reduce expenditures for treatment and would dramatically improve the quality of American lives. Secondly, as you will see from people speaking in Poverty, Inc., the film, we're not a lazy nation. We work ourselves to death. Virtually all the people that I filmed had multiple jobs, but they were paid too little. There was a time from about 1945 until 1975 that Americans made enough money because there was more demand for the labor and there was a conscientious representation of bargaining together through unions that a person could have a living wage. Only one member of the family had to work, and there was enough to pay all the bills, plus have savings, and have quality of life. Today, for at least 200 million Americans, 100 in dire poverty, that does not exist. So we have to stop looking at the minimum wage the way we have, both from the corporate blue dog Democrats and the Republicans. Their only interest is in how they can argue, and speciously so, that we have to protect corporate interest. That paradigm has failed. We've embraced it. Keynesian economics, the Milton Friedman School of Economics, where you give money and power to private interests and they will cause a trickling down. That's a lie. It never had occurred before, and it cannot be used any longer. Instead, we have to give a higher living wage, and not just a minimum wage. Ideally around $20 an hour, as Denmark does. Currently, the minimum wage is $7.25. So if you want people to be able to go to a movie theater, which today there was an article in the paper saying that people are not going to the movies this holiday season because they can't afford it. Well, when people don't have extra money, they can't spend it in the local economy. It used to be in 1957, a dollar was spent 57 times changing hands within a community. Today it's under 10. That's no way to support a community. So the small shops don't have that dollar. The small businesses don't. So we need to allow some of that corporate profit to go to the employees. Instead, we've emphasized only on the huge bonuses and the massive inequality of people who are not the best and brightest. And by the way, as an aside and on a personal level, I counsel all types of people. But I've also counseled some of the most powerful people in the world, including members of royal families. And I can tell you, don't for a second ever think that anyone who is famous or a celebrity or powerful or rich is smarter than you. I can attest from firsthand, not hearsay, many of them are as dumb as bricks. And you just are amazed. I'm amazed how in the hell a person ever got that successful. When if you see them without their PR spin and their Photoshop images and their retainers and their technocrats and bureaucrats telling them how to think, you think, how in the world did this happen? We live by illusion. So why not stop making these people so rich and spread the wealth? We also need a national transport system. When you look at China's and France's and other countries, they are way ahead of us. We depend upon automobiles far too much for work and daily needs compared to other nations. In addition, the United States keeping gas prices low compared to other nations. Another reason is that its public transportation systems, trains, buses, and subways, are dismal. Investing in a new national transportation system would wean the U.S. away from reliance upon driving, reducing greenhouse gases, and dependence upon oil, and would provide tens of thousands of much-needed jobs. Also, it would mean we wouldn't be flying to California or Chicago or other places. We could take a high-speed train and be there in hours. That's what we should be investing in. We should also have a Reforesting America program. During the FDR administration, the Civil Conservation Corps was created. It was one of the first New Deal programs, serving as a public work relief program for unemployed and families in financial straits. For the 9 years the Civil Conservation Corps operated, over 3 billion trees were planted in America, and 800 parks were established nationwide. A new Reforest America program would provide numerous jobs to the unemployed, reestablish soil conservation that would serve as a carbon sink to reduce atmospheric CO2 to lessen the pace of global warming. We can employ easily 5 million individuals and would help reverse a lot of the desertification that is occurring in the United States. We also should initiate a national geothermal initiative. The U.S. currently leads the world in having almost no geothermal. And we should have geothermal because we do have geothermal springs. It's a source of clean energy. Currently, there are only 19 larger geothermal plants producing 50 megawatts or greater, and the majority of these are located in California in the Geysers region, the world's largest dry steam field. Geothermal has a higher capacity factor of 92% compared to nuclear, coal, and other renewable energies. It's always available. We need to have more energy-efficient homes and commercial construction. If we had a national policy that implemented the mandates that all new homes and commercial building construction, particularly in warmer climates, have some type of renewable energy source installed, either solar panels, solar paint, newer, affordable small wind turbines, we would get people off using all this electricity for heating and cooling. We should have a national grid protection. Federal officials from NASA and the National Security Agency have warned of the fragility of the nation's energy grid and its susceptibility to solar storms and cyber and terrorist attacks. And a Class 5 solar storm would likely destroy the U.S. network of grids. Therefore, a national project to protect every power station is warranted and overdue. We should also have, in every state in America, a number of colleges and universities that are completely free. The disgrace of our higher education, forget just the curriculums, which are biased, taught by frequently stupid professors who are biased. And when did they go on strike on support of their students' debt peonage and debt prisons? They haven't. So please don't tell me about how concerned you are for your students. I'm going to be sharing a commentary in a moment about what I think of you. The majority of you who are doing nothing to inspire a deeper, more passionate sense of commitment to questioning everything, so people at least have the critical faculty to know how to question authority. Since 1985, college tuitions across the board have increased by 500%. That's 500%. And much higher in the elite schools. Do you really think that you're brighter? You think your education is better in elite school? That is an illusion. Harvard, Yale, Princeton, do you think that they give you a better education than any other accredited school? They do not. That is our need to feel special, our need to feel that we are attached to something greater than the sum total of our own inadequacy. We live by these illusions. Other nations such as Brazil, Germany, Finland, France, Norway, and Sweden are doing the opposite of the U.S. In those countries, university education is free. The U.S. needs to make all public colleges free. Private schools can still exist. You can charge everything you want. You can put anyone you want who wants to go to these stupid schools in as much debt as they choose to be in, or their arrogance demands that they graduate from one of these private schools. But for the vast majority of people in America, we must demand free education, and we should not support any college or university until it's done. We should relieve all student debt now. American student debt currently stands at $1.3 trillion and growing. Over 70% of students carry college debt with an average of $35,000 per student, but that does not include interest, and that could double. So the average student could pay $75,000 to $100,000 before they get out of that debt. Such debts carry a fixed interest rate, now reaching 8%, with limited available jobs after graduation and even less living wage jobs. Student loan debt is a national disgrace, and it creates an entire debt peonage for younger people. Now you have 27 states that are allowing debtors' prisons, and guess who could be filling all of these debtor prisons? Students or the person who signed on the debt. Therefore, a moratorium needs to be effective that forgives all interest on all student loans immediately and the right to declare bankruptcy. We need state banking systems with all other private banks. Right now, we need to look and see what's working, what's not. Only the state-run Bank of North Dakota earn profits after the 2008 meltdown and currently leads the nation's banks in economic sovereignty. Far from being a model of socialism, which is why corporate Republicans and corporate Democrats oppose the North Carolina model, this model makes loans far more affordable, with student loans at low as 1% and fixed mortgages at 2.2%. State banks have also now been proven to increase jobs while bolstering state treasuries, which have equally been hit during this recession. Then two more things. Let's start the process of de-ghettoizing America. Throughout the nation's infrastructure is collapsing. While some urban and suburban areas that suit the wealthy and upper middle class continue to develop, the rest is being left to fall into ruin. Racial segregation, rather than breaking down, is again increasing and remains at a very high level. Today's largest urban ghettos are found in Detroit, St. Louis, Washington, D.C., Atlanta, and Newark. Besides unsanitary living conditions, ghetto residences lead the nation in illnesses, disease, poor education, unemployment, less productive small businesses. Corporations that could provide jobs and revenue to lift Americans out of poverty avoid locating near ghetto areas. Therefore, a de-ghettoization program that would provide a two-for-one tax credit to companies and small businesses can increase living standards and serve as a platform for ridding the nation of ghettos. Revenues would be reinvested into the ghettos to build community complexes that enable residents a higher standard of living. These would include schools, assisted living center and rehabilitation centers, adult education programs, community gardens, and restoring small businesses to increase trade within the communities. It would not be based upon gentrification. Let's also tackle the offshore tax haven dilemma. Currently, there is at least minimum $32 trillion stashed away in offshore havens by the super rich. And since it is impossible to have access to many of these offshore banks, the actual figures could be much, much higher. All of this money is not taxed, meaning there's a huge flood of potential revenue lost to solely benefit the elite. Before going after the super rich and those who play the offshore tax haven card, the government should offer a one-time forgiveness to those hiding profits from the IRS. No punishment, no recrimination. They simply pay a 20% fee, and they can reincorporate that money, bring it back, tax-free after that, to use as they will. That would immediately mean that the United States Treasury would have $6 trillion that it didn't have before. Now throw in what we would get from doing a health care program correctly, saving $1 trillion and making $1 trillion. Now we've just added $8 trillion. And then, of course, what is very radical but needed is stop all interest payments by no longer allowing corporations that don't pay taxes to end up getting supposedly loaning money to the Treasury through the Federal Reserve to pay our taxes, and simply no longer allow that and no longer allow trading in derivatives and make every corporation in America responsible. If you go broke, no one bails you out, period. And then we would see all the major banks fail, as they should, and be put out of business, as they should. And then we could take over from there. We would not suffer. We've been lied to, as you will see from watching the experts in Poverty Inc. We were lied to at every level, and it was always by people who all came from Wall Street telling us we had to bail them out. And now by law, we have to bail them out. Rescind that law. Initiate a flat corporate tax of 20% without deductions. Eliminate the IRS. Simplify the tax laws by getting rid of all tax laws. Everything. The entire bureaucracy, put it out of business. That's one group of unemployed people I would be happy to see go. The IRS. All of its agents. These people act like a Gestapo. No more tax havens. No more tax avoidance. No more CPAs. Whatever you make, you pay 20% in. There's no excuse and there's no allowance. That's it. That would give us an additional $3 trillion a year. Free all people incarcerated in private prisons, debtors' prisons, for simple drug possession or not being able to pay their bills. How wise is it for a nation that considers itself exemplary to take someone who cannot afford to pay a bill, who's living at the bottom rung socially and economically, and then punish them by putting them in prison so you can further exploit what money they don't have by creating a debt they can never pay. This is demonic, and it shows the worst that we are as a society. It's not just the bankers who do this. We already know what sociopathic and psychopathic tendencies they have in people at all levels of the political spectrum. This is about us now. Close down the prisons as we know them, and all the all of the people committing crimes, expunge those records if they are nonviolent crimes. And all the people who have ever been arrested because of marijuana or drug possession, expunge the records. They can reenter the workforce and have a life. Those are some of my ideas. I take full responsibility for them. I will not compromise on them. I believe that we have done too much compromising on all principles that are essential to our well-being as a society. And look at the consequences. Look at the people we put in office. How'd that work out for us? Just take a look at where we are today. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Someone asked me at the premiere, a person who identified themselves as a professor from Columbia University, that what do we have to do to get the teachers, the professors, to join with the students? Because I'd mentioned that if there's two ways that you could have major change in America. First, if you had the hundreds of thousands of wealthy African Americans and Latinos join together in solidarity and to ask for general strikes, take a city at a time until there was major input and oversight where you actually had some authority to see that corruption, bigotry, racism stopped. And if not, you close down the city. Radical? Yes. Necessary? Absolutely. Otherwise, nothing happens. And I ask, where are these people? And I said, then if you did the same thing in academia, we all know the plight of students. We all know the challenges they have. But where there is a unification of them, you have little episodes out in a small number of people out at University of Berkeley, but that's only because their tuition was raised. But what if their tuition wasn't raised? Would they care about other people being in debt? Obviously, this is not something that's gained a lot of traction, but it should, because if all the teachers, in support of all the students, went on general strike at every university and college in America, that would get people's attention. And then if every student refused to support the very corporate interest, the very banking interest that are putting him in debt peonage, that would get attention as well. Ideological fundamentalism and political purity appear to have a strong grip, both in the United States and Canada, because we have a lot of listeners in Canada. And it is this ideological fundamentalism that's preventing this, in my opinion, and that of Professor Henry Giroux. Why? Because we see an endless attack on reason, truth, critical thinking, and informed exchange. For example, in Canada, Prime Minister Stephen Harper decries what he derisively attacks as intellectuals and journalists who he says are committing sociology. What does he mean? He means holding power accountable. For Harper, the attack of committing sociology becomes synonymous with removing critical thought from both the university and the public discourse. In one instance of ideological suppression, the Harper government has been accused by a number of scientists and academics of a pattern that has been seen where they simply reduce media access to scientists and cut funding and programs because it challenges their fundamental view, for example, on the destruction of climate change. Well, then again, look who gives them the money. Big oil, the tar sands. Of course, in the United States, political illiteracy seems to be the one qualification besides great wealth that gets one elected to political office. At the same time, celebrity culture smothers the U.S. with a rampant idiocy that practically ensures that violence is largely experienced as entertainment, further reinforced by an anti-intellectualism that provides the foundation for paralyzing most forms of critical and engaged agency. Now, this type of fundamentalism might be expected in a society that has become an increasingly anti-intellectual, given its commitment to commodities, violence, privatization, the death of the social, and the bare-bones relations of commerce. But it is more surprising when it appears in universities, especially among so-called liberals. In this instance, political fragmentation and desperation of the fog of insularity appear to be producing a form of ideological fundamentalism fueled by a take-no-prisoners version of political purity that is wrapped in a kind of self-righteous moralism. Attend any WBAI station board or any of the station boards and you'll see exactly what I'm referring to. This is a moralism marked by an inability or reluctance to imagine what others are thinking or even caring. Was it not Immanuel Kant who once said to think in the place of the other person? Yes. This type of ideological self-righteousness by so-called liberals and progressives, and sometimes elements of the orthodox left, is especially dispiriting because it makes a mockery of academic freedom and often condemns other positions even more than what we are aware of. Rather than open up conversations, which we desperately need, we need conversations on every college campus, by the faculty, by the students, together as equals, saying what is wrong with the curriculum, what is wrong with how it's taught, what is wrong with what you're paying, what is wrong with the budget of this university, what is wrong when a university president makes $5 million and you can't afford the food on a college campus, now their campus food kitchen's opening up to feed students who are hungry. If we can't have an open conversation with this, then you shouldn't be teaching at university and you shouldn't be studying at university that is not willing to acknowledge the criminality of inhumane treatment of the student. Rather than open up conversations, this type of power terrorism closes them down and then collapses into a kind of comedy of intellectual boasting while assuming the moral high ground. Hubris becomes more than shameful in this instance. It becomes toxic, blinding the ideological warriors to their own militant ignorance and anti-democratic rhetoric while shutting down any notion of the university as a democratic public sphere. What is lost here is how the repression assumes a revolutionary stance when, in fact, everything about it is counter-revolutionary. In the end, this suggests a kind of theoretical helplessness, a replacing of the inability to think with a discourse of denunciation and a language overflowing with binarisms of good and evil. What is at risk here is both the moral collapse of politics and the undermining of the very nature of critical thought and agency. Now, of course, this raises the question of how one survives in the university without being in exile, or at the very best, existing with one foot in and one foot out. Such attacks have been waged against critics who speak outside of the box of normal political positions. Historically, these would include people like Scott Nearing, who I knew, and Paul Sweezy and I.F. Stone, to more recent radicals such as Norman Finkelstein and Stephen Salindia. One can hear echoes of such attacks on women who criticize some version of what might be called the Take No Prisoner, All Boys Club in administration, critics of the Israeli government, critics who call for overcoming political fragmentation among the left, theorists who speak of the need for emancipatory forms of leadership and authority, while refusing the so-called leaderless revolution, with calls for long-term organizations and strategy, and so it goes. So let's just think of this for a moment. There are those of us who talk about power in the tradition of Raymond Williams and Stuart Hall and others who are viewed as not being abstract enough or relegated to the garbage because their theories are considered irrelevant. What the fundamentalists cannot understand is that the call for lifting ideas into public life supports the assumption that theory is crucial, but should be accessible and address important social issues. In this instance, matters of politics, morality, and relevance are all stripped from theory, but give it life, room to breathe, and connect it to the rhythms of everyday life. In other cases, intellectual capacity and insight collapse into biology, as certain individuals and groups are excluded from voicing a position because they are deemed not authentic enough. And how bad is that? When someone doesn't meet the needs, they're considered mediocrity. And as a result, when they try to voice their concerns, why don't we go on protest? Why don't we have a general strike? They're viewed as hysterical ranters and are resented. There is backbiting and the endless production of irrelevant research. And most universities have nothing but irrelevant research. But it supports them and they keep their mouths shut. When the military-industrial complex comes to a college, it comes with deep pockets and endless capacity to write checks, and that suddenly co-opts any of the true and honest people who are receiving that money. When was the last time someone who received a large university grant then turned around and showed how that grant was subordinating democracy, freedom? No. Universities more often than not have been compromised, and those who have not are not given a forum or marginalized. How can one not be in exile working in academia, especially if one refuses the cliques, the mediocrity, the hysterical forms of resentment, the backbiting, and the endless production of irrelevant research? These spaces have become dead zones of the imagination, mixed with a kind of brutalizing defense of their own decaying postures and the search for status. Leadership in too many departments is empty, disempowering, and utterly rudderless, lacking any vision and sense of social responsibility. Students are constantly being told that they should feel good instead of working hard and focusing and developing critical thinking skills. We no longer ask students what they think, but how do they feel? Everyone wants to be happy as a consumer, including a student consumer. When students are told that all that matters for them is feeling good and that feeling uncomfortable is alien to learning itself, the very nature of teaching and learning is compromised. This is the academic version of a Dr. Phil TV show and often results in modes of power that are as demeaning to students as they are to professors who take on the role of therapists who speak in terms of comfort zones but rarely offer support in the interest of empowering students rather than infantilizing all of them. This is not to suggest that students should feel lousy about themselves or that educators shouldn't care about their students. They should. But caring in the most productive sense means providing students with the knowledge, skills, and theoretical rigor that offer them the kinds of challenges that make them feel good about what they have accomplished in their capacity to grow intellectually, emotionally, and ethically. Or as Victoria Harper puts it, because they had accomplished something, they had learned to grapple with different material, understand critical ideas, and even started to engage in real dialogue. In the neoliberal university, there seems to be a pathological disdain for community, trust, and collaboration. As the bounds of society and social responsibility are undermined, all that is left is a kind of sordid careerism and the quest for status and some financial crumbs from the corporations and defense contractors. What remains is the insufferable cultural capital of academics bounded by the private orbits and such interest that they have to focus on where they get their money. These are the academics who have surrendered to a regime of conformity and instrumental rationality while reducing politics to a private endeavor. At their most cartoonish moment, they appear to inhabit a kind of cultural capital made visible by their desire to be affiliated. Well, stop for a moment. Rigor, public scholarship, integrity, in my opinion, they're in short supply. So is sanity. Under such circumstances, I believe it is the person who stands up, speaks out, and tells the truth that is doing us a service, even if it may embarrass us at times or even if it may reflect on what we have not done. Hence, in my conclusion, I'm calling for all students and all teachers to challenge student curriculum, to challenge student debt, to challenge the penal system, to challenge the laws that have been implemented by those in power, because it holds all of this at varying levels hostage. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you for listening. Joining me in studio, Jeremy. Hi, Jeremy.
Good afternoon, Gary.
Jeremy has been with us here for a couple of years.
That's right.
And he's now going off to California.
That's right.
To be with his family mm-hmm. and his new child. And we encourage you in that. And you wanted to come in just to, because so many people in this audience have come into contact with you. And Jeremy has helped with so many things, from helping to organize all of our film showings.
That's right.
And retreats. Mm-hmm. So you have a few words to share with the audience. Those people won't be seeing again.
Absolutely. I wanted to just take the opportunity and reflect back on the last few years. It's been about 3.5 years here, and they have flown by. We keep really busy here, working with you, Gary, and your fantastic crew. So it's just been a tremendous opportunity, all in all, to have participated in all the meaningful projects we've undertaken here. The current premier, Poverty Inc., is just the latest example of the powerful and important work that comes out of the office. So, you know, your documentaries, they cover the issues that are underreported or simply ignored by the mainstream media and even a lot of other alternative news media. So it's one of the things I've really loved most about being here is the fact that we bring to light critical issues and we get the discussion started in the articles and books here on the radio show, of course, and the other great programs at PRN. It's always about presenting material that's going to raise the consciousness and allow people to listen to a variety of informed and educated perspectives and dig deeper than what you're going to see, obviously, in the mainstream. And I know and I've seen how empowering the information can be, because I've seen the transformations that people undergo after spending, you know, a week at one of your retreats or implementing the lifestyle protocols. I've seen how listeners respond so passionately and really in such great numbers to your calls to action, and seeing the listenership of PRN expand as more and more people have come on board. It's a wonderful thing to see. The spread of empowering information rather than, you know, the fear-based reporting that goes on in the mainstream. So to sum up, it's just been a pleasure to work alongside such a talented, creative, and compassionate team of people. The crew you've assembled, they're absolutely wonderful. And being here, I've learned so very much about activism, health, and healing, and the importance of having independent, progressive media. So I just wanted to thank you so much for this opportunity. It's been very special.
Good. Well, we're going to miss you. And today's Jeremy's last day. And when you're out in California, make sure that you visit frequently. That'll raise your IQ by 10 points each trip back. We'll miss you, buddy. All right.
Thank you.
And by the way, everything you learned here, including taking all the documentaries, take one of all the documentaries and start sharing it out there.
Sure will.
Because you do have a small activist group out there.
Absolutely.
Who are willing to make some positive changes. We're out of time. Let's say hello to Utrecht Lead. Hi, Utrecht.
Hello, Gary. Today we're talking about people like Sharpton, for whom police killings are now an industry. And we're talking about President Obama tonight attempting to temper the outrage over racism and injustice.
Did you ever think about inviting Al Sharpton on to discuss these issues with him?
Oh, yes, I have, but I have not gotten a call back.
Oh, all right. Have you ever spoken with him?
Oh, I know him quite well for more than 30 years.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, we're going to find this interesting conversation. Al Sharpton, give Utrecht a call. She's waiting.
Yeah, I am.
I got your letter.